Welcome to Ants, Humans, and Stars. I am Digo, your digital nomad for today. And we have Caleb here, your fabulous singer, songwriter, and extraordinaire.
An artist with a story to tell.
Awesome.
Still telling stories.
Still telling stories.
Still.
That's what we do here.
17 episodes in.
Yes.
And a few bonuses. Mm-hmm. Check us out on YouTube as well. We're now there.
Yes.
Today I'm going to cover just right on time May Day, which is May 1st. And Caleb is going to cover.
I'm going to be telling you guys about Everybody Wants to Rule the World by Tears for Fears.
Okay. For the setup, I needed the title so we can launch to everywhere. And I was like, Tears for Fears. You stumped me. I like, got what? Nothing, you know.
You know what I was thinking? I was like, 30 years from now, we're still going to be doing some iteration of this. We'll probably have a TV show by then. And I'm going to be talking to Digo and I'm be like, yeah, I'm doing this song, Oprah Winfrey. And he's gonna be like, Oprah. I'm gonna be like, Black Lady Talk Show, 90s. Oh, okay. Digo just needs references, okay, guys?
Yeah, he
needs
references. Really references.
To connect the dots. I understand. It's all right.
I hope everybody had a wonderful April. How was your April?
My April was not bad. It was good. A little slow, but it's okay because like next month's about to pick up. So April was slower than March. But
I celebrated something in April along with millions of people across the world. I hope you were...
Yeah, 420. Okay. I was like, is that what I think? Yes. And hey, it's illegal here in Virginia now, so... When you get back,
it blows my mind. By the way, I'm so ecstatic that is now part of my life. Well, I celebrated here in Costa Rica, where chill. And
that's what you do when you celebrate 420. You don't get hype. You get chill.
you get chill. You get super chill. You guys have chill. You pass out for a little while. Wake up again.
Right.
Eat. Smoke some more.
Which I will say, I don't know if I told you, but your cookies that you made when I came were actually just really good. Along with like just being perfect, because I got the perfect amount of chill. Mm-hmm. They actually were just good. Like they tasted good. Like they were good cookies. So just kudos.
You'd be surprised how butter and sugar just has magic.
Right.
Just put butter and sugar together. Yep.
There you go.
So... When I told you what I was doing and you were like, excuse what? And you expressed the general feeling, sentiment across the United States when anybody would say May Day, like other than the radio call, May Day, May Day, May Day, right? Mm-hmm. But like May Day, May 1st. Meaningless.
I didn't even look it up. I was like, I'm just going to wait for you to tell me about it.
Okay, but I will get into it. The history, where we are with it, the struggles. And I've pulled from history.com, pbs.org, time.com, and Wikipedia. There have always been many events and festivities around the world, at least in the Northern Hemisphere, that celebrate spring in some fashion because it's the time of the year to reap and sow the harvest. You're starting the harvest, you're picking, depending on what kind of agriculture you're growing. We have Easter, which is, right around this time. That's a very spring type popular holiday, but which is a rebranding of Passover, which is in itself a rebranding of the Canaanite Agriculture Festival of Spring. So these holidays around these times, whether they be Christian, Jewish, Muslim, or any non-denominational, it's kind of like spring is here. Let's celebrate. Mm-hmm. In the Canaanite Agricultural Festival, that's when they would make that unleavened bread that's popular in the Jewish tradition. So... Mm-hmm. But that was mixed in with this Egyptian blood ritual, which they did this to prevent demonic forces from entering the home, or like in a book commonly known as the Bible, there's a chapter in there called Exodus, and that's where the Yahweh God has told this pesky Egyptian pharaoh, let my people go, like 9 times already. And so by the 10th time, Yahweh meant business, sends the angel of death, takes out all the firstborn sons. Yay for feminism. And but
he's killing kids.
Just killing boys. But like death did not kill those who had the lamb's blood on their door. So that mixed with the unleavened bread, and here we got Passover. P.S. You know, there were people like fighting how much blood they should smear over the doorway when they were like, the angel of death is coming. We got to put freaking blood. You know, you know, right. They were like,
well, that's what I was thinking. I'm like, yeah, like how much was it did you have to put on? Was it?
You got
to
put all of it.
Paint at night. But you know what? See,
dripping blood.
Well, see, you know, that's the thing. I was like, I'm just going to think about myself. The OCD in me would be like, nah, we're going to make sure this is nice. I don't want no wood shown. Like, we painting right. This nice. Like,
Jedediah, get Abraham and Elijah over exactly. To Ezra and Jacob's place. Exactly. We need to tell them we need more of that lamb's blood. We need this door red.
All of it. Yep. All of it.
Anywho, so there's also this very white-centric May Day festival goes way back to the Gaelic Celtic islands of Scotland, Ireland, and the Isle of Man. They believe May to be the most important time of the year. They celebrate Beltane, one of the 4 Gaelic seasonal festivals, along with, get ready for me to butcher this, Samhain, Imbolc, and Lugnasadh. Butchered it. Okay, all of these festivals have to do with harvest, either getting ready for it or reaping it again. And a popular tradition of May Day involves the maypole. People dancing around a pole, white people dressed up, drunk and high and having a good time with a dash of fertility, and you get this maypole dance. And if you've ever seen Midsommar, that horror movie, you know what I'm talking about. P.S. What a creepy movie. That. It's about this. It's about May Day but this crazy ritual and these group of kids who get sucked into it. So it's a good watch. A lot of white people. I've never seen so much whiteness. in the 19th century, May Day took on a new meaning. A political meaning, as a day for workers and for workers' rights. It grew out of a labor movement in the United States. And before you start getting proud of that, don't be proud of that. There's nothing to be proud about that. There were things so bad in the United States that they had to do something about it. And one final note before I dive into this. Again, I mentioned May Day, May Day, May Day. What does May Day have to do with the international distress call? Mm-hmm. Nothing. The code was invented in 1923 by an airport radio officer in London, challenged to come up with a word that would be easily understood by pilots all around in case of emergency. Frederick Mockford coined the word Mayday because it sounded like the French term for come and help me, which in French is like pour vivre midday. So Mayday.
Gosh.
So in the United States, during the 19th century, at the height of the Industrial Revolution, thousands of men, women, children, everyone, were all dying every year from the worst fucking conditions, the impossible long hours. Working conditions sucked. In an attempt to end these inhumane conditions, a bunch of peeps known as the Federation of Organized Trade and Labor Unions, which would later become known as the American Federation of Labor, the AFL, held a convention in Chicago in 1884. They proclaimed, 8 hours a day shall legally constitute a day's labor from May 1st, 1886 and onward. So in 1884, they were like, in 2 years, a work day is going to be 8 hours. End of discussion. Drop the mic.
So it's their fault.
No, I mean, they were just like, look, that's it. May 1st, 1886. Mm-hmm. You're going to, we're not even going to, that's just how it's going to be. Mm-hmm. I think that's, you were basically giving them 2 years notice. I mean, hey, you know, the Knights of Labor, then America's largest labor organization, backed them and encouraged workers to strike and demonstrate. So on May 1st, 1886, more than 300,000 workers, 40,000 in Chicago alone, from 13,000 businesses walked out of their jobs across the country. And in the following days, more workers joined in, and the numbers grew. Overall, the protests, they were peaceful. But that all changed when Chicago PD and workers at the McCormick Reaper Works factory clashed. That factory, it was located on the north bank of the Chicago River, east of the Michigan Avenue Bridge. But before I get into that, let me tell you about some two random dudes. Okay, there was Albert Parsons, August Spies. Both these like young white dudes. Albert Parsons was the leader of the American branch of the International Working People Association, the IWPA, an anarchist group that stated goal was to engineer a social revolution that would empower the working class. Hmm. He was a Confederate soldier. This is like back in the day, right? He's a Confederate soldier who became a radical Republican after the Civil War and married a former slave. See, now, in the 1860s, and this is what I said I would get into, in the 1860s, Republicans were liberal, mm-hmm. and Democrats were conservative. Mm-hmm. That switch happened in 1936, and that's why this is all fucking bullshit. Party lines are not real. But anyway, it used to be that businesses needed things. We're talking about the 1800s, right? Mm-hmm. Businesses needed things that only big governments could provide, like trains, roads, power, utilities, right? That sort of thing. And once these things were in place, it was like, we done with y'all. Let's get you off my back. Small hands off government became better for business. Switch happened there. August Spies, that other dude, what a fucking name, by the way. Spies. August Spies. he was the editor of an anarchist newspaper, The Alarm. Together, Parsons and Spies got together and addressed the working class community of Chicago, calling for demonstrations and organizing parades. The IWPA had at most 5,000 members, but their tactics were confrontational and they worked. So demonstrators would snake by the clubs and homes of the elite, shouting slogans and waving fists. Articles in the anarchist newspapers explained how to make bombs with dynamite, and editorials supported the assassination of public officials. On his desk, August Spies kept a length of pipe he claimed was a bomb. Dynamite had just been invented, so, you know, they made a man, woman, Neither, both. The equal of an army, so bombs could be carried around in your pocket, so they were all the rave. and now, they were like, fuck that 20-hour-a-day nonsense. Need my sleep. Need to see my family and friends. So, May 1st, 80,000 workers laid down their tools, and they also marched behind August Spies on Michigan Avenue. Hundreds of private security and militia groups monitored the march, but nothing happened. It was peaceful. Nearby, a strike at that McCormick Reaper Works factory, 200 policemen led by Captain Blackjack Bonfield, what a name, Blackjack attacked the crowd at the factory, swinging nightsticks, firing the guns. Two workers were killed there. Mm. The anarchist, fucking mad, you know, they're like over here in the city peacefully protesting. Yes, this is going on. Yes, it's part of the protest. But, you know, I think the general sentiment is that those police instigated this.
Yeah.
And so they called for a rally the next day at Haymarket Square to protest the deaths. Mayor Harrison had Blackjack and his men on standby a block from the square. The mayor was in the crowd, making himself as conspicuous as possible. He said, quote, "I want the people to know their mayor is here." After him and spies and Parsons spoke, rain began to fall. It dispersed the crowd. The mayor left, and he told Blackjack, "We're done. There's no threat today." After the mayor left, however, Blackjack sent in his troops. From somewhere in the crowd, a bomb was thrown in front of the columns of police. And when the dust settled, 7 police officers were dead, 60 were injured, many of them hit by wild shots from their own fellow policemen. A like number of civilians were killed and injured, although the number is uncertain because few would admit to being at that rally. I want to point out here that there's a small thread through many controversial uprisings for the sake of civil rights, that somewhere there always seems to be a trigger point, usually at random, that when you look at it closely, it isn't really connected to the core of the movement, rally, or protest, but it will inevitably get shared along with the uprising so as to trigger fear. Look at these thugs, look at what they're doing. And everything's a conspiracy, but I've heard enough of these to just see this thread of, if there's an uprising, a protest, and in this, let's use, you know, Black Lives Matter, and you're against it, you're against the movement, this is an example, you'll go to that rally or protest, throw a rock through the target window.
Mm-hmm.
Just to incite something so as to give the image of violence.
Yeah.
But the actual protesters had nothing to do with this. So this is...
We saw that like all last summer. I mean, I had a friend who was at a... this was before last year. And she was down south, I want to say North Carolina, Georgia or something, like at a rally. And she told me how they're just, marching peacefully and the police just bombard them. Just start throwing tear gas and rubber bullets. And it's a total just instigating when they were peaceful. And
let's plant the drug.
Exactly.
Let's plant the evidence. Let's give the reason ourselves so that we can move in and no one will blame us. Because, you know, somebody threw a bomb, you know, in this case. Yeah. So, the Chicago PD rounded up suspicious foreign workers and anarchist leaders. 8 men stood trial for the murder, including Parsons and spies. No one had been identified as the actual bomber, but 8 defendants were tried as accessories to murder based solely on their speeches that day.
Wow.
Their defense lawyer provided alibis for all of the men. The only 2 who were actually at the rally at the time of the bombing, spies and Parsons, were on stage in full view of the crowd of the police and the police. Mayor Harrison even testified that the rally was peaceful and attended by women and children. And look, this is the 1800s, so Mayor Harrison, white as hell, right? So a white mayor is even, you know, everybody here is white, but I'm just trying to say, like, it's like, there's white people right here. You know, like, shouldn't you believe these people? No, it's just, there's oppression. Sometimes it's not linked with racism. Sometimes it's some other thing. And here's this example, but it will eventually always be tied to racism. I will get into it, of course. The prosecuting attorney, however, declared that the law is on trial. Anarchy is on trial. Gentlemen of the jury, not ladies and gentlemen, because it's 1800s, right? So there's just a bunch of white men in this jury. Convict these men. Make examples of them. hang them, and you should save your institutions and our society. The all-white male jury reached a verdict: death by hanging for 7 of the men and 15 years in prison for the 8th, August Neep. The wives of the defendants immediately initiated an appeal process. Like, what the fuck? Journalist Henry Floyd led a national campaign to grant clemency. Even the judge of the trial wrote a letter to the governor on behalf of two men who had asked for mercy. Their sentences were commuted to life in prison, but only those two, because the law required that each prisoner ask for clemency. So only those two, and everybody else was like, no, I ain't asking for forgiveness. One of the prisoners, even Louis Ling, had a dynamite cigar smuggled into his cell. He completed suicide in prison, blowing his face off. They're serious. I love the revolution drive these guys have. It's intense.
Seriously. Blowing your face off.
I know. On November 11th, 1887, the remaining prisoners were brought out to the hangman's platform. Their original trial had been on June of 1886, and this was now only over just a little over a year later. So things moved quicker back in the day when it came to death sentences. So that day, Albert Parsons, August Spies, George Engel, and Adolf Fischer stood before the crowd with hoods covering their faces. August Spies' famous last words were, "The day will come when our silence will be more powerful than the voices you're throttling today, sir." He meant that their deaths would spark far more outcry than any rally that Parsons or Spies could ever organize. Mm-hmm. Which was true. As Star Wars would put it about a century later, when Obi-Wan fights Darth Vader in the first of the originals, Obi-Wan's like, "You can't win, Vader. If you strike me down, I shall become more powerful than you can possibly imagine." Vader kills him. And in this story, the trapdoor opens where Albert, August, George, and Adolf drop below and are strangled slowly until they're dead. That same year, a nationwide economic recession. Yay! It's good times. George Pullman of the Pullman Palace Car Company laid off hundreds of employees and cut wages for the remaining workers of his railroad sleeping car company by some 30%. Meanwhile, though, he refused to lower rents in Pullman, Illinois, his town, the company town south of Chicago where many of his employees lived. So he's like, cut their wages, but your rent stays the same. What a bitch. Angry Pullman workers walked out of their jobs on May 1894. In the following month, the American Railroad Union and its leader, Eugene V. Debs, declared a sympathy boycott of all the trains using Pullman cars. So the Pullman strike was huge. It effectively halted rail traffic and commerce in 27 states, stretching from Chicago to the West Coast. And on June 29th that year, someone derailed a U.S. mail train. So this is getting out of control in the eyes of the federal government. Attorney General Richard Olney used the train derailment as an excuse to ask the feds for help. And then President Cleveland dispatches federal troops to the city. It's never a good thing. Illinois, the governor, John Peter Altgeld, he'd already called for militia troops to prevent violence, and he was mad as hell that the federal government came in, and he said those acts were unconstitutional. But they arrived anyway, and the Pullman strike turned bloody. Rioters destroyed hundreds of railroad cars in South Chicago. Okay. So the National Guardsmen came in and fired directly into the crowd, killing many 30 people and wounding many others. As this was happening, you know, not like literally as it was happening, but like during these months, Congress passed legislation and made the first Monday in September the federal holiday to recognize labor. Mm-hmm. President Cleveland then signed that bill into law. A few days later, after he signed that bill into law, he sent those federal troops to South Chicago. So it's like, yeah, I'm helping and not.
Yeah, not helping. Yeah.
But you could also put this in perspective and cue the racism. All of Pullman Company workers, all of the Pullman Company workers, like he specifically sought out to hire black people. So that massacre that happened then, they're all
black people.
They're all black people. Wow. So you can even probably think, oh, yeah, let's have a Labor Day. But this is for white people.
Yeah.
You know, that's probably the thing. And then, yeah, you send these troops to, what, a bunch of black people? Whatever. It just that has nothing to do with labor. Mm-hmm. I could see this thinking. Federal troops were eventually recalled from Chicago on July 20th, and the Pullman strike was declared over in early August. So now we have Labor Day in September, when the rest of the world celebrates it on another day. Throw this up there with the imperial system and Fahrenheit. it's like we don't want to do anything that everybody else is doing. Like, No. We're going to do it on our end.
Mm-hmm.
So fast forward to April 29th, 1919, a spring day in Atlanta. Housekeeper Ethel Williams received the morning's mail for her employer, former Senator Thomas Hardwick. There was a parcel, which she opened. The explosion took off her hands. Mrs. Hardwick, standing nearby, had also suffered burns. The previous day, a similar device had been delivered to Mayor Ole Hanson of Seattle. Fortunately, Hanson's clerk, who opened the parcel, he opened it upside down, and that made the bomb fail. And so he discovered the chemical vials inside and realized what it was. And then it was like, oh shit. Authorities realized what was going on, began frantically searching for other devices. All in all, 36 parcels were traced and intercepted. The targets included U.S. Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., U.S. Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer, John D. Rockefeller, Sr., J.P. Morgan, Jr., cabinet members, mayors, state legislators, and captains of industry. The bombs were intended to be delivered on May Day, the International Workers' Day, and the mechanism was designed to detonate when the parcels were opened. There were no notes, no demands. The anarchists believed that the propaganda of the deed, that the bombings and assassinations were messages in themselves. But one of the intended recipients of that parcel bomb, of those parcel bombs, was Rame Weston Finch, otherwise little-known agent of the FBI, who had arrested two followers of the anarchist Luigi Galliani. By the way, I said FBI, but the FBI didn't exist, I think, at the time. So it was just the Bureau, some Bureau of Investigation. Anyway, the decision to include Finch in this list of bombings was weird because he was hardly of national importance. And so that was the thread that led investigators to find what happened, focus on Galliani's group, and they were unable to pin the crime on a particular individual, but the anti-anarchist laws of the time meant that they didn't really need to. Political sympathies were enough. Further bombing through the summer and harsher responses from law enforcement encouraged public fear and random violence. As well as introducing more oppressive policies, the period would help cement anti-leftist attitudes in the U.S. and help make socialism an unacceptable political idea for decades. Socialism became a dirty word, and it was used as a way to discredit and undermine leftist groups. In the United States, concern that immigrants were bringing violent political activism with them led to harsh crackdowns focused on particularly Eastern and Southern Europeans. How far we've come with that.
Right. Exactly.
There would be further bombs, strikes, race riots, various groups of the left, including many who would not associate themselves with anarchists, became linked to the public mind with violence and outrage. Socialist, Bolshevist, anarchist, whateverist, they were all presented as a public threat. It was a threat that U.S. government responded to with urgency and would continue to respond to even today. May Day is currently embraced by many people worldwide, not just those with socialist and communist influences. Today, it is an official holiday in 66 countries and unofficially celebrated in many more, but ironically, it is barely recognized in the country where it began. And last, but certainly not least, May Day was the fictional bodyguard, lover, and assassin employed by billionaire industrialist Max Zorin and portrayed by the notorious American singer and blacktress, the one and only Miss Grace Jones. The character May Day acted as the secondary antagonist in the 1985 James Bond film A View to a Kill. She has also appeared in video game adaptations of the James Bond franchise. And if you're asking, who's Grace Jones? Literally, get out of here. No, I mean,
exactly.
You're 15 and under, or even 25 and under. I don't know if you would know who Grace Jones was.
Yeah.
But Grace Jones is a triple threat. Legendary supermodel of the world, disco queen, and a prolific actress. After becoming a constant fixture in the Studio 54 nightlife scene in the 70s, Grace Jones went on to embark on a career spanning music and film. The Grammy-nominated singer infused her work with genres of reggae, R&B, and new wave while starring in films including Conan the Destroyer, her music video / documentary, A One-Man Show. That's the one where she's got that iconic image where she's very androgynous and she's kind of looking to the left. It's like that iconic, that's that cover from that documentary.
Gotcha.
And of course the Bond film A View to a Kill. She is, in one word, fierce. And that, ladies and gentlemen, either or both, are a few tidbits about May Day that you could bring to those cocktail parties that you are not going to. For me, May Day has always been, because of the duality of the holidays of the United States and the holidays of Central America. But when I actually came across this whole drama of May Day and U.S. history, it was so natural for me to think, like, I'm going to disconnect from this September Labor Day holiday nonsense.
Yeah, completely.
I'm going to join in the rest of the world on May Day.
Yeah. Wow. See, I'm changing all holidays. Labor Day is out. July 4th is out. Juneteenth is in. Yep. May Day is in.
May Day is in.
Yeah.
The most effective tool those in power and oppressors can have is divisiveness. The more we're fragmented, the easier it is for them to eat us.
Mm-hmm.
So let's unite and let's be one on May Day, May 1st. Hashtag eat the rich.
Mic drop. I love it. That was very informative. I knew nothing about that. Wow. Interesting. Very, very interesting. But informative and good.
And there are pieces.
Yeah, like we need to know that.
And there are pieces of this that I left out that, like, you could do a whole podcast series on May Day because it does involve, like, the idea of using May Day for specifically the 8-hour workday and workers' rights and all of that maybe came from Chicago, but it wasn't the first time it was introduced.
Mm.
It was just like how it became popular. So there are, there were pockets of this sprouting up yeah. and it had to do obviously with the Soviet Union and all that stuff too. And so there's a lot of backstory here, but basically the marriage of spring and workers' rights, the kind of revolution, rebirth. I don't know why it made sense, but it does. And May 1st, here we are. That's tomorrow. Interesting.
Tomorrow is May 1st. Yep, yep, yep. Wow. Thanks for that. That was, yeah. See, you're still learning even after you get out of school. Actually, you learn more than when you're in school.
YouTube University, Wikipedia.com. Like, woo!
Exactly. YouTube University.
My principal, my principal is my teacher is yeah, my principal is YouTube, my assistant principal is Wikipedia, my teacher is like history.com, math.com.
Google's just running the whole school, but yes,
yeah, uh-huh. It's like literally the foundation of the school, like the brick and mortar of the school is Google.
Exactly.
Oh man.
So, you ready?
Ready, steady, go.
All right. Tears for Fears. So, this duo consisted of Roland Orzabal. I thought that was such an interesting last name. And Kurt Smith. They're from the UK. Like I said, they're part of... They come in on the tail end of this British invasion in the mid-80s. So, they originally started as History of Headaches. But they changed their name after being influenced by the primal therapy pioneer Arthur Janoff. He has a book called, it's like The Primal Scream or something. And I guess from my research, it's kind of about how your childhood traumas can just affect like your adult life and stuff. I don't know anything about the book. Oh, yes. No, that's true. I'm just saying like this is what apparently the book is about. But like... Don't completely quote me on that because I've never read the book. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how that correlates to like their name. This is just, I'm just giving you all the research, okay? I'm just reporting the research. that after reading this book and being inspired by it, they changed their name to Tears for Fears. So in 1983, they released their first album entitled The Hurting, and it was a huge hit in Europe and pretty much all over the world except the US. The album went to number one there. Three of their singles went to the top five in the UK. But things were different in the US. Like I said, the only single from that album to even chart was their song Change, and it peaked at number 73. So, but again, the album was huge everywhere else. And so after it was put out, the record company was like, hey, we want a follow up. And basically just give us the same thing because we're just trying to repeat this. But the record company, and then also Tears for Fears were hoping to break into the American music scene pretty big. So, sorry about that. There's record company pressure after the first album. Singer Kurt Smith told the Los Angeles Times in 1985. I should probably do this in an English accent. It was successful worldwide. Okay, no, I'm not going to do it.
It just wasn't coming. It wasn't coming.
He's like, nope. Nope. Wait, I'm not doing that. I am not.
How do you get into this? Wait. I need to talk like it. Okay, so it was successful worldwide. They wanted us to do another album, no matter what the quality.
Okay, I'm done.
Like, I'm so sorry, Kurt.
You started like in central London, took the U train, right. And you went down to East Australia. London. And you were like, you took a flight to Australia, back to East London.
I'm sorry, Kurt. Whenever you listen, I'm sorry. Okay. Next time you just come on the podcast and you can talk to us. But he says it was successful worldwide, talking about the album. He says they wanted us to do another album no matter what the quality, just as long as we did it quickly. But we weren't willing. So they started work on their second album entitled Songs from the Big Chair. They enlisted help from their friend Chris Hughes, who was the former Adam and the Ants drummer. And he also produced The Hurting, their first album. But they're very meticulous about it, and they spent several months trying to get it just right. "We started an album at the end of 1983, but we didn't like it," Smith told The Times. "It was too much like the first one, and we were determined to do something different." So finally, a year later, they felt like they created a complete vision. Their song Shout would anchor the project, and then songs like Mother's Talk and Head Over Heels were going to be positioned as future singles. So again, they've gotten all these songs together and they're like, okay, like this is it. We've kind of got an album and an idea of where we're going forward. So then Hughes heard Orzabal fooling around with a couple of chords on the guitar one day. "I just had a rhythm on a rhythm machine and had an acoustic guitar with the bottom string turned down," Orzabal told the Orlando Sentinel in 1985. "I really didn't think it would be a hit." But Hughes was really intrigued by it, and so he kept pushing them to just keep going with it. So Orzabal co-wrote the song with Hughes and their keyboardist Ian Stanley, and the lyrics ended up touching on just a wide array of contemporary issues. So then Smith came in. He literally says, "I came in one day and they'd actually written this song around this beat and it was very commercial. So they said, here it is, you're singing it, go and do it. So I did." But even then, Orzabal was a bit reluctant, pretty much at every stage of putting the song together, saying that the shuffle beat was, quote, "alien to our normal way of doing things. It was jolly rather than square and rigid in the manner of Shout. But it continued the process of becoming more extrovert." He told Super Deluxe Edition in 2020, just last year, "If it wasn't for Chris, I don't think Everybody Wants to Rule the World would even be a song. He pushed that 100%. I didn't like it, even though I came up with the main body of the song." So they finally finished it. Orzabal actually changed the title from Everybody Wants to Go to War to what we know that it is now. Because again, they wrote this song in the middle of the Cold War is going on. So Smith told Consequent Sounds, in a separate interview, "We're talking back in the days when you made albums and not singles and pillow tracks. So it became not necessarily a concept project, but you would have looked for something that was a complete body of work that works well together. And we felt that's what it was by the time we had done Everybody Wants to Rule the World." Even the post-production process was completely different for this track. So apparently they spent 4 days on Shout alone, their song Shout. But their mixer, David Bascom, told Mix in 2007, "With the other songs, there was a lot of second guessing, making sure every sound was really pushing the band. But this was more straightforward." So it sounds like they pretty much, like that song just came and they weren't so focus on every little piece the way they were the rest of the tracks on the album. So they originally intended for Shout to be the album's debut single, but their U.S. label thought Everybody Wants to Rule the World would work better in America. Shout everywhere else in the world.
What?
The song Everybody Wants to Rule the World will do well in America, is probably the most logical, straightforward, totally grounded statement anybody can make.
I didn't even think about that until you just said that, and that's so true. Shout Everywhere Else in the World was actually the first single. And to everyone in Europe and to us at the time, we thought that was the obvious single, Smith says. We actually disagreed with the American company who made Everybody the first single. So on March 18th, 1985, the song was released and it arrived at just the right moment in the U.S. There was a brand new generation that was beginning to examine environmental issues, turbulent financial times, the Cold War, disinformation, and of course, governmental overreach. And these are all things that are touched on in the song. And really, if you're not listening, you could completely miss it because I kind of knew what the song was about, but I play this song whenever I do shows. I'll be playing it later today because I have a show later this evening. But it really does hit on these such a wide array of serious topics. I'm just going to read the first verse. It says, "Welcome to your life. There's no turning back. Even while we sleep, we will find you. Acting on your best behavior, turn your back on Mother Nature. Everybody wants to rule the world." So there's like a whole lot in there. There's environmental stuff, turn your back on Mother Nature. There's kind of this existential realization of like you're here now, like there's no, you're in this world and you're living this life and in this, in the structures, you now you just got to deal with it. There's no press and rewind. It's my own
play the game.
Exactly. Or try and change the game. It's my own design. It's my own remorse. Help me to decide. Help me make the most of freedom and of pleasure. Nothing ever lasts forever. Everybody wants to rule the world. Eduardo Crasta of Arrow Crave. I don't know if I'm saying that right, but that's what the website is called. You can go check it out. He commented on the song and he says, living for consuming, consuming in order to fully enjoy a precarious and temporary freedom threatened on all sides by clouds that promise the storm, the terrible spell of a few rulers. Beyond a few joys, a desolate scenario, tensions between the United States and Russia, nuclear tests, dreams of collapsing buildings. He references the line, holding hands while the walls come tumbling down. When they do, I'll be right behind you. And then he says, the song, quote, speaks to the anxieties of all ages. Smith even told MTV, it's about everybody wanting power, about warfare and the misery it causes. So, take in mind the subject matter, the times in which this is coming out, along with, like I said, Tears for Fears is coming in at the tail end of the second British invasion, and just the fact that the song is just infectiously catchy, all of that just completely helps it propel its way to number one. And they pretty much became one of the musical rulers of that summer and year in 1985. On June 8th, the song took the number one spot from Wham's Everything She Wants. Again, Wham is a British group, English group. It was on. Who's, it was number one.
Like most famous singer is
George Michael.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. Wake me up. Okay. So Rule the World spent 2 weeks on the top 100. And then again, just on the British invasion thing again, Wham single had replaced Simple Minds, Don't You Forget About Me. And if you don't recognize that song from the title, if you've ever seen Breakfast Club, that's the song that plays at the end. Mm-hmm. Don't you forget about me. So
what British, Stewie from Family Guy does a spoof on, like, you know,
oh,
Family
really?
Guy will spoof everything, right?
Yeah.
But that he did that, like, they're like, it's the end of the thing and he's leaving
and he jumps
and there's a song playing and this said that song and it's Stewie just doing that the whole scene.
So again, with Simple Minds, then Wham, and then Tears for Fears, British acts held the top spot for 5 straight weeks. And then this number 5 is just starts to appear everywhere. So 5 weeks after that, their album Songs from the Big Chair topped the Billboard 200 album charts. And it was the first of 5 non-consecutive weeks that it would do so. So Smith later admitted that it was, quote, interesting in retrospect because it was one of those times when the record company was right and we were wrong. For America, yes, it was a better first single. And Everybody Wants to Rule the World helped make that album Songs from the Big Chair just, it was huge, multi-platinum, sold over like 5 million copies within like the next year, and Everybody Wants to Rule the World is known as Tears for Fears' signature song. And so it just, they just marked their 35th anniversary, excuse me, last year for the album. And Orzabal is quoted as saying, as we move further and further from that decade and you keep hearing Everybody Wants to Rule the World in various forms, I do think it is an era defining album. And I did listen to the album for the first time last night because I'd never done so. I've heard their song Shout. I've heard, of course, Everybody Wants to Rule the World, but it is a really good album, and yeah, they definitely have like a sound, and their subject matter is very introspective. I like it. I thought it was great. I also thought it was really interesting how he said that for once the record company was right, because so often on this podcast I talk about artists who the record company's like no, and the artist has to
don't
push,
make it
like,
don't make it, it's gonna be shit.
Exactly. And the artist has to push that, no, it's going to be good. And then the record company is like, oh, you were right. So this was interesting that For once, the record company did the right thing and made the right decision.
These are two white men.
Right.
And sometimes and that then, helps.
Yeah. And then later on, like, Shout went to number one as well, the original single that they wanted. So it was just huge for them. And the song's been covered by a lot of people, from Nas to Lorde, and it's been used in tons of shows and movies, like you said, since Pooch and Family Guy. It's been on so many shows. And then just a little PS, the song was banned for broadcast by the BBC for the duration of the first Gulf War. So from August 2nd, 1990 to February 28, 1991, it was banned due to the song's political themes.
Jesus.
Which that's I thought so was really interesting.
That's only a few decades ago. Yeah. You know, like, it's just in the 90s.
And it was the 90s, banned. Yeah. So that was only 5 years after it came out. Yeah. Just for its political themes, which really, I was actually reading this one article from this guy who I pulled some stuff from stereogum.com. And he was going over the song, and then he was saying in his write-up how he doesn't like that the song only hints at these things. Like, it's not, the song is not very direct. Like, it's very, like, it's giving you these lines, and then it's like, here, you can kind of interpret them. Mm-hmm. Again, like I quoted, they've both come out and said that, yes, the song is about wanting power, it's about warfare. But that's not explicit. So it's interesting that the song was banned when, again, this isn't
right.
It's the song. The lyrics aren't explicit of this is what we're talking about. This is what we mean. Mm-hmm. So that goes into a whole conversation of censorship and whatnot. So it was interesting. But
and in the 80s was also the popular time of every man for themselves. Let's get rich. Let's mm-hmm. rule the world.
Yeah.
And so it makes sense that this song was like made at that time and to have all that subtext. Obvious.
Exactly. And they were very young. Like, I want to say they were like 24, 25. Because their first album, they were 21.
But that's the idealistic age right there. Right
yeah.
in my pocket.
well, yeah, because that's when you're starting to realize
the house, like, is on fire.
Oh, yeah. Really? You're starting. Yeah. Like, that's really when you're starting to, like, oh, everything is not what I thought it was. And wait a minute, they said it was this and it's not. So yeah, mm-hmm. it is definitely that age of awakening in a sense. So.
You mentioned that book, Primal Scream, and it perked my ear because you said trauma. And so I looked it up. The Primal Scream by Arthur, not by Arthur, like author. No, his name is Arthur.
Mm-hmm.
Janoff. And so he is notably the creator of Primal Therapy, treatment for mental illness that involves repeatedly descending into, feeling, and experiencing long repressed childhood pain.
Yeah, so yeah, I did. I'm reading my thing now.
The fact that you're saying this is coincidental because I'm not going to get into the specifics. I think I'm going to keep the anonymity of who I work for. So they were doing a session live on Zoom, and what they did was this is relationships, right? So the woman was saying, you know, this, that, and the other about her husband or boyfriend, and you know, in the session, the guy gets to the bottom of what is affecting her with the boyfriend, right? Or whatever that is. Mm-hmm. And then walks her back to her childhood, right? Which is a typical thing to do in therapy. But I'm seeing this happening live, you know, and she's like, I work for this company. This isn't scripted. We pre-selected them. You know, as in, like, write in, tell us what you want to talk about. And of the list we selected, okay, this one might be the most interesting one to do. That's it. You know, then she's on and she's telling whatever it is that she's going to come up with and how. And anyway, so they brought her back to her childhood. And she, brought up that her father was more neglectful than abusive, but basically a deadbeat dad. You know, that's mm-hmm. what was coming out. And that he made her admit that she was never mad at her dad. But she had never thought about that ever at all. And in the
he session, made her admit that she wasn't mad?
Right, that she had never felt... The anger was at herself, at her boyfriend, at everything.
Gotcha. Except instead of pointing to her, going to her dad.
Which was doing this. And so what they did was they tried to get her to imagine herself as that little girl, but not like herself in her... No, like bring it up in front of you. Mm-hmm. Look at yourself as a little kid. And then protect yourself. Like...
Mm.
Like, say you went back in time and you found your little self. Like, obviously, you're going to protect your little self, right? Like, of all else, you're going to protect your little version of yourself. And to put that little version of herself behind her and address her father.
Mm, and wow.
Say everything. And she was like, ah, you know, like, you're a fucking, you know, she just let it, something that she didn't, you know, feel. She felt, but she didn't actually realize, you know, that she had all this.
Yeah.
And that all that, I'm sure the boyfriend was shit, you know, but all that anger, that fire was primarily because of dad. And mm-hmm. it was being vented to the boyfriend.
Yeah.
Once she clicked all these things together, then she realized exactly what she needed to do. And to what she wanted to do and how she wanted to refocus and fix everything and you know, take steps. The trauma that we all have and we go through from childhood to the ancestors to the 10 years ago to the 1,000 years ago to the 100,000 years ago when or 500,000 years ago, whenever humanity started, has never been addressed. It's never it's never been fixed. It's never been healed. One trauma compounds the other, and so many things come from this. You know, and so this is in this example. You know, it's very, you know, micro here in her.
But I think
and
that's where it starts.
But the macro version of how this happens when a whole society is traumatized, but. Doesn't realize how they are or talk about, doesn't talk realize
about, yeah you can talk you about know, slavery whatever. And how that affects and again something no one wants to talk about but it's like do you not people haven't even begun to connect the dots to see how breaking up of families 200-300-400 years ago how that affects communities now
right
and like
and it you know, I know there's
that's just one part
so
of it.
Much so many people that say this thing how, you know, for black people it's like you're being forced to race through and process your trauma as if 400 years ago slavery was invented and died 400 years ago. Like 400 years ago slavery and then 339-99 years ago it was over. Mm-hmm. And then ever since then it's been golden, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's never been okay. It's just 400 years of sludge, compounded trauma upon trauma, and this is only one sector, one factor, one area of humanity. And so, anyway, that's a lot to say, and it's really cool that these guys were focused on this sort of thing, and it's a very popular thing to have been focused on in the 80s, of course, because straight out of Vietnam, right? And that's, it's so disheartening that it 100% applies 2021, April 30th, May 1st, by the time this comes out.
Mm-hmm.
Everything they said in that song, everything John Lennon said in his song, every poet, every writer, 1,000 years ago, same exact thing.
Still applies. And again, going back to what we were talking about, how like that around that age of early 20s where you're kind of awakening to things. As I was going through that, one thing I noticed was like, these are not issues that are new. like they were talking about these, the same issues we're talking about now, whether that's, you know, black people fighting for their rights, LGBT people fighting for their rights, women, like this is all stuff that was going on. They were talking about this on Golden Girls. Mm-hmm. Like, and I remember watching an episode being like, oh, like they talking about this, like the way we talk about it now, like it's not some, it was just plain, like, yeah, we're having these conversations too. And this is 30, 40 years ago. And so, yeah, there's just this realization of like, none of this stuff is new. Mm-hmm. Like the fact that we're still, I think it's a shame, really, that we're still dealing with other things, because none of it is new. None of it. People mm-hmm. our age, 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago, were literally saying these same exact things that we are now. But we're still here. And yes, we have moved slightly, but we have not moved near enough for, based on the fact that, again, these are all conversations that have already been had. None of this is new. None of this popped up, oh, a year ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago. This is, no, they've been talking about environment and trying to get these billion-dollar companies to get it together and, like, pay attention. Like, this didn't just start with our generation. So, yeah, it's very interesting.
There's a comedian who's like, I forget, he's this popular black dude. I can't think of his name right now, but I think he's on The Daily Show. Anywho, no. SNL guy, the news anchors. There's a white dude and a black dude. The black dude. He's like, yeah, man, like gays and trans, you know, whatever, like just other people in movements are like asking for human like rights, equal rights, and black people only be asking is civil rights. We're just trying to be civil here.
Yeah.
Black lives matter.
Matter.
We're not saying like they're better. No. They just matter in the most basic day. Do you want us to go back? Do you want to say black lives exist? Can we start there? Anyways, yeah, he went on a whole thing. But I looked at the timestamp. That shit was 2017.
Again, man. Yeah, this is
4 years later. It applies just even as more
relevant. Yeah, yeah. That, and that's also kind of like not scary, but like.
No, it is. Of course it is.
It's scary, but it's also just like it can almost make you feel like hopeless. Like, all right. Like what? Like you said, the fact that not only is it still relevant, but it's even more relevant now. You know, you can look at that song and say, like, even more now we're trying to deal with environmental issues. Even more now we're trying to deal with, you know, it's not Russia anymore. Now it's North Korea and other countries. Like, it's even more now.
The beauty of it is that it's all not real. As in, there's no real government. There's no real society. There's no real rules. They all exist in our heads. Actually, collectively together as humans, we are existing in our heads.
That this is
just
what we're going to adhere to.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that can be scary too, but that also allows me to just believe that change, to obviously. If it's just in our heads,
then we can change it. Exactly. Right. It's like how I feel. Yeah. It's like the police. Like, just because this is how we've dealt with discipline. To put it that way, for the last 100-200 years, does not mean, again, it didn't, that's not how it's always been, so we can now change it. That was created, it was a thing, so now we can create something new that's better. So yeah, you're right, that is a good way to look at it. That,
and to end on a positive note, from the Good News Network, 72% of Brits feel more content as they finally stop worrying about what people think of them in their 40s. Self-conscious Brits finally stop worrying about what other people think of them at the age of 46, according to a new poll. A survey of 2,000 adults aged 55 and over found they feel comfortable in their own skin when they turn 42 and become content with their careers around the age of 40. As a result of feeling comfortable in their own skin and unapologetically themselves, 72% of adults feel more content in life. There's more to that article, but I thought, that's cool. We have 10, 15, 20 years or so to get content.
All right, I'm going to try and get there before 40, but yes.
Fight for what you love.
Fight for what's right. And check your humanity.
Put
next put month, your mask Gemini on. Season.
Gemini okay, season. Put your mask on.
Put your mask on. Yes. Wash your hands.
That's an order, Marine. Where's that from? Oh, Independence Day. Why has that never come into my existence until a year later? It's Will Smith. Mm-hmm. He's flying the F-16 along with his fighter pilot. And they're being chased by one of the aliens. Have you seen this movie?
I have, but it's been so long.
Right. No, this is fine. And whatever. This is the famous scene where he like ejects from it, and then he hits the. But before that, he's flying with he's flying away from the alien, and his co-pilot in another plane like tries to do this maneuver, and he's like. Freaking out, he can't breathe, he takes his mask on, and Will Smith is like, quote, put your mask on, Marine, it's an order. It's like, where Will Smith, we needed you last year. We needed exactly. That whole meme. We needed that scene to come out over and over again to be played on Times Square, like Will Smith.
Yeah, that's
put your mask on, speakers. Marine.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, put your mask on. Get your vaccines. If you can.
I'm getting mine next month.
Nice.
Let's see if I can.
Karens, go home.
Mm-hmm. Just huddle amongst yourselves, you know?
Right.
Like, right.
Find a cave and just
chill out. We don't care about you. I think that's what it is. Like, we don't care about you at all. You hate everything, but we don't care about you. If all you did was stay home, or stay out of everyone else's business and existed, we'd be fine. I don't care. Yeah, you could be right next to me on the bus, in the movies, anywhere. It's fine. As long as I don't know of you, I don't sense you, I don't hear you, I don't just do whatever. You're not in. That's it. It's not asking for much.
Really? We just like, stay. Just keep your mouth closed. Just save all that for when you get home.
Mm-hmm. For that bad sex you're having.
Bore those kids with all that complaining.
You heard it here. I'm also live on I've been live on what's this called? What is this?
What is it called?
What is this?
We just live. I don't know where.
We're just live. Instagram. Thank you.
Hey, Instagram.
But they've been listening to just one side of the conversation the entire time.